Welcome, I'm Jonathan Portis, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at King's College London and Senior Fellow here at UK in a Changing Europe. And I'm very pleased to be here today on our podcast with Dr. Raqib Ehsan, somebody whose career I've followed for some time. We've had some exchange occasionally combative exchanges on Twitter, but I think we've now settled down into a more constructive, albeit not always consensual, Twitter and intellectual relationship. And it's really nice to have somebody here who I think whose ideas and research I find both interesting and challenging. So, Raqib, before we start to talk about your new book, which will be the main topic of today's, do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing now?
No, sure. Well, firstly, thank you, Jonathan, for having me. So just to talk a little bit about my background, I'm a very proud Lutonian. I've lived here in Luton pretty much all my life. I was born in Hammersmith, but the family moved to Luton when I was a very young boy indeed. In terms of my background, I specialise in matters of social cohesion, race relations, public security. These are kind of themes that I'm very interested in. I did my undergraduate degree, master's and PhD all at Royal Holloway University of London. I'm very much a thoroughbred Hallowegian. In terms of the work I'm doing at the moment, I had the book Beyond Grievance published very recently in June. I'm currently doing a number of projects associated with immigration, identity and integration. So essentially my bread and butter.
Okay, so let's get straight into your book, which, as you said, is called Beyond Grievance, What the Left Gets Wrong About Ethnic Minorities. So I think I'm just going to hand it straight over to you to tell us what the main thesis is and what we should be taking away from it.
No, absolutely. So I think in recent times I found certain, if you could call it liberal left narratives, surrounding the life of ethnic and racial minorities living in the UK, somewhat suspect. I think that all too often it's been strikes quite a depressing tone, overly doom and gloom. So more than anything, I think what I wanted to do with the book is to talk about the positive social, economic and cultural environments on the ground. And what, in terms of the book itself, I think one of the main things that I really want to tackle is what I consider to be this importation of toxic racial identity politics from the United States. And I think you've described it previously quite brilliantly, almost like a sort of slavish fascination with American politics. And I think the argument that I really make in the book is that while I do think there are improvements to be made in our multiracial democracy, I talk a fair bit about how police-community relations need to be improved. I actually call for the breaking up of the Met. I actually think it's too big to succeed. I've also talked about problematic health-related outcomes, especially when it comes to Black British mothers and the maternal mortality rate. I think it's just four times as high as their white British peers. I talk a great deal about equality of opportunity in the labour market. A good friend of mine that I look up to, Sundar Kotwala, who spearheads the British Future think tank, he's talked a lot about name-based discrimination in the labour market based on a range of CV-based field studies, which tends to affect ethnic minority applicants with sort of quite culturally distant names, maybe perhaps a name like Raqib Ehsan, which is quite Muslim sounding as well. So I wouldn't say that I look at my country through rose tinted spectacles, but I think that when you consider other countries such as France, we've seen in recent times the riots in France, I think there's a great deal of alienation in many of its immigrant communities. And I think that's largely because of its sort of rigid secular universalism, this so-called colorblind egalitarianism, which has actually bred this sort of this political culture, which is reluctant to acknowledge very real forms of racial and religious discrimination. And I think that when you look at the United States, it's a completely different national context, Jonathan. Still struggling, a relatively youthful experiment, which is continuing to get to grips with the legacy of slavery and segregation. So I think that for all its flaws, I think we actually have a multiracial democracy that we should be proud of. And I think that it should be a source of national pride.
Let me dig a bit deeper there. So I mean, I think what you're saying here is you know, something that I think does have a lot, and your book has a lot of evidence and data behind this, that the UK picture is very much at least a glass half full and perhaps a bit more than that. And certainly that the glass half empty narrative that we get to some extent on the right, but certainly, as you point out, on the left, isn't a very constructive one and isn't actually going to, perhaps most importantly, isn't actually going to appeal to the vast majority of ethnic minority people here who are not particularly sort of, you know, whose main priority, like everybody else here, is simply about making a life for themselves and for their families. So what are the lessons that perhaps particularly people on the liberal left should take away from this in terms of concrete policy actions and political messaging?
No, absolutely. I think that the key point to make in this context is that ethnic minority Brits, just like the white British counterparts, they ultimately expect fairness, not favours. And I think that when drawing inspiration from US identity politics, I'm not necessarily in favour of racial quotas, for example, that sort of US-style affirmative action. I think the argument that I would make is that that might even undermine the authority of genuinely talented, high-ability ethnic minority people in higher-up positions. I think that when you're looking at the right, and I've criticised the right a great deal, I think that there's plenty to criticise from a liberal left perspective when it comes to the sort of new Conservative Party, you could say, which doesn't only draw inspiration from the excesses of French republicanism. I think at times they admire Orban-style ethno-nationalism as well, which I just find absolutely ridiculous, because we live in a country where people ultimately have a very civic concept of nationalism, or rather patriotism and national identity. So I think for elements of the right to go in that direction is most unfortunate. I think in terms of looking at concrete policy action, I think narrative setting is also very important. I think that just talking more about families and communities, you have those sort of traditional small-c conservative attitudes in many ethnic minority communities, which go that ultimately you're more than just an individual. I think family duty, that civic mindedness, community spirit, I think that makes for a very wholesome message. I think in terms of a sort of policy action, I see that the Labour Party is looking to potentially introduce a new Race Equality Act if it was to return to government. I'm just not sure that's the right way forwards, or rather that's not the appropriate focus. I think there needs to be more of a policy understanding that puts the family at the heart of key government decisions, whether that's housing, healthcare. I talk a great deal, because look at things from a traditional left perspective. How do we introduce stronger family-friendly rights for workers more generally? So I think it's ultimately looking at how we can create a more family-friendly society. And I think that could apply to a variety of public policy areas.
So I think, you know, in some sense, of course, most people on the left or in the Labour Party wouldn't have a problem with the idea that, you know, there should be a focus on providing affordable childcare, particularly to less well-off working families from whatever background. But let me just press you a bit more on some of the things in your book where you talk about the sort of social conservatism, as you see it in some ethnic minority communities. And, you know, I don't think this podcast isn't probably the time to talk about the substance of things like trans rights or whatever. But, you know, do you think that Labour needs, or the left as a whole, needs to change policies here, or just the emphasis, the way it talks about these things, and how will that affect its interactions with ethnic minority communities?
I think that there's, and I'll make this point, this doesn't characterise the Labour Party, but there's a section on the left which I do think they could show a greater appreciation of the role that faith plays in many ethnic minority people's everyday life, that it's a source of optimism, it can be a source of resilience to cope with the everyday challenges of life. I think in terms of social conservatism, I'm very open in the book as well, that particularly when it comes to perhaps lesser integrated elements of British Muslim communities, there is a debate to be had about female empowerment, and that there are issues such as honour-based violence, which, as you know, I've spoken about very robustly in the past. But I think more generally, for me, it's more about appreciating small-C conservative values, which are not doing any harm to other people in society. And in fact, values which actually provide young people with that sense of belonging and rootedness. I don't know if this is necessarily a socially conservative point, but I think that, for example, we do have issues surrounding knife crime in London, for example. And this is something that David Lammy, who, I wouldn't say necessarily the most hardline conservative politician I've come across, even he's talked about the role potentially played by absent fathers when it comes to knife crime in London, especially in a more deprived Black British communities. And I think there is a debate to be had that if people truly care about young people's progress, especially in inner city areas where there are many young Black British people, I think we should talk a bit more about family structure, the positive role that responsible males can play, responsible fathers can play in terms of raising their children in a good and proper way. I don't think these are necessarily socially conservative points. Some people may well consider that to be the case. But I think that unless we really get to grips and acknowledge the very real impact of family structure and young people's outcomes, then I don't think necessarily we're going to have the healthy and honest social policy discussions that we need.
So let me just press on that, because I mean, you know, in my former life, when I was a civil servant at the Department of Work and Pensions, working on policies around child poverty and the benefit system and so on, you know, there is no doubt that overall outcomes for children in single parent families are, for a combination of reasons, are worse than those in two-parent families. Now, we know that that's partly about economics, about incomes, and it's partly about other things. And I think few people would deny that those sort of things you're talking about are relevant. But when it comes to, you know, and I noticed you say we need to have a debate about that. And I always, the phrase, we need to have a debate about X, and of course I use it myself sometimes, it always makes me feel a bit skeptical when it comes to policies, because it often means that the person who's saying it thinks that there's a problem, but actually can't really put their finger on any concrete policies to address that issue. So we might all agree that in an ideal world, more children would have more stable and supportive family structures, and that would lead to better social outcomes. But that in itself doesn't tell you what government, or indeed, you know, society more widely, should actually do to get us there from here.
No, absolutely. I think I'd take on that point completely, Jonathan. But it's also an argument that I make in the book, that there's a limit to what the government can achieve. I think that if we had, if the Conservative Party, for example, wasn't the kind of party that, where you have a very strong section of the base admiring, almost idolising someone like Boris Johnson, someone who has a very chaotic family history and marital history, I don't think that's entirely helpful, because I think what you want, you do want a political leader who has sound moral standing on these kind of issues when talking about it. I think in terms of policy, I talk a great deal about, you know, how we can introduce more family-friendly policies, but ultimately we're talking about a matter of social attitude. How do people view themselves in society? The trade-off between individual freedom and family responsibility. I'm quite traditional in that I see marriage as an institution, and also having children, that there's an element of self-sacrifice involved in that to a degree, that you have to sacrifice a degree of individual freedom for the greater civic good. in a sense, whether that's your capacity, in my view, as a, you know, as someone, you know, whether it's as a husband or as a father. So I think the point I'd make is that we acknowledge these problems, but actually, how do you go about addressing those problems from a policy perspective is quite difficult, because much of it is actually about how you shift social attitudes. How do you shift attitudes towards marriage, towards sort of almost a trade-off between individualism and collectivism? And that's not necessarily easy to achieve through social policy. I've argued that maybe the government should really look into a sort of exciting grassroots agendas where you do have responsible male role models in communities which are at risk of family breakdown. Support them so they can put their own, you know, put up and implement their own projects in their communities to champion a positive pro-family, pro-marriage message. So it's not so much as just from government. You actually have this taking place in communities. That's something that I'd really like to see. And I'm surprised it's something that I haven't really seen under a Conservative government. We've had the Tories in power, Tory-led rule for 13 years. So I think those are the kind of things that I'd really like to see. But I think the argument that I'd really make is that there is a limit to what the government can achieve. And much of it is down to those sort of classic Conservative values, such as personal responsibility and individual initiative. You can influence that or push people in a certain direction through policy, but I think much of it has to actually be through grassroots social activism.
Yes, I mean, I have to say, in some ways, this to me, you know, does sound not dissimilar to the sort of agenda that we had, you know, 15 years ago or so, where the role of policy, as it were, was to support families through things like, you know, economically, improving labour market support through the benefit system and childcare, and at the same time to support the voluntary organisations in the third sector at a local level. I think, as you say, the Conservatives indeed came to power with, you know, David Cameron's Big Society was in principle, and to be fair to Cameron, I think he did at the time genuinely believe this, that this sort of change would have to come from the bottom up. But I think what he missed was that can only happen when you actually have the sort of basic level of services at a local level, and local authorities in particular, properly funded to do what they need to do, and to be able to support, to enable that sort of third sector infrastructure, which is a prize. And unfortunately, that seems to have been rather hollowed out over the last 10 years or so.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think I witnessed that in my own hometown. If truth be told. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's why many people in these neck of the woods, even those who are quite traditional and conservative minded, they saw the Big Society more like a big con. Ultimately, the sort of idea was, you know, we'll roll back the state, but those sort of third sector and voluntary organisations that you speak of, they'll plug those gaps. But what the government, the coalition government, didn't seem to understand or didn't want to understand is that there needs to be a certain level of initial funding in place. So you set up those social infrastructures, they perhaps then become more self-sufficient and become more embedded in their communities. And then perhaps over time you can think about those organisations weaning off that kind of funding. I think to do it as abruptly as they did and not really understand that you need that certain initial phases and stages of funding, mm-hmm. and instead went about this sort of, you know, this sharp austerity programme, I think that was hugely problematic for many local communities.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to remind you all to sign up to the UK in a Changing Europe newsletter, which comes out each week, featuring our latest research and news about our exciting range of events. Subscribe now on our website, which of course is ukandeu.ac.uk. Can I talk a bit more about the sort of how you see different ethnic minority communities' values and politics evolving in the years to come? Because, I mean, one thing that struck me, and you did sort of allude to this a bit, was that, you refer to some ethnic minority communities having fairly socially conservative values based on, to some extent, on religious traditions and to some extent based on other cultural traditions. But, I mean, I certainly recall that certainly when Labour abolished Section 28 or whatever it was called about the promotion of there was a lot of talk then about how this would drive a wedge between Labour and the Muslim community. And in fact, there have been some fairly isolated incidents of conflicts between some Muslim parents and schools where they are teaching, in the personal and health and social and sexual education in accordance with what we now sort of consider to be more or less normal. But on the whole, that hasn't happened, right? And in fact, most Muslim MPs voted for gay marriage when it came to it. Mm. And the Muslim, as far as I can tell, polls suggest that most Muslims don't necessarily, quote, approve, unquote, of gay marriage, but equally, they don't regard it as in any sense something that drives a wedge between them and wider British society. It's regarded as something that, that's part of what this country is, and we're fine with it, as far as I can tell. Would you say that's fair? And is that evolution likely to continue?
I think that's a fairly accurate description. I think I'll make the point that, and we just have to be honest about that, there's a notable section of the British Muslim population that sees homosexuality as a sin.
Yes.
From a religious perspective. But you also say that in terms of the legalisation of same-sex marriage, you did have British Muslim Labour politicians vote in favour of it.
And some conservative ones as well.
And some conservatives as well, precisely. So I think what the matter is, and I think you touched upon it quite importantly, it's more when socially conservative parents believe that certain materials are being presented to their children in state schools. I think that's the issue. And if they view that as a promotion of homosexuality, which conflicts with their religious teachings, or rather the religious values they want to cultivate in their household, I think we have seen those tensions arise, especially in parts of inner city Birmingham. So I think there's an acceptance, yes, that same-sex marriage is legalised, it's in British law, but it's the degree to which how it's presented or possibly promoted in state institutions, especially schools where there are British Muslim pupils. I think, and I think it's the more the perception that parents may have in terms of how aggressively that's being taught, and the degree to which that teaching contradicts what they would like to promote either in the household or what their children may be taught in Islamic supplementary schools as well. So in terms of how serious that tension becomes, I think that just purely that depends on how severe a problem it becomes in particular communities, or rather the perception that parents have in terms of how serious an issue it is. I think Labour naturally has a number of group interests which can be in conflict in a way, and I think that, to be honest, I think you're more likely to see that truthfully with trans rights, especially in its more radical form. I think that there's British Muslim women, which I'd consider to be quite liberal minded, and they talk a great deal about female empowerment, but they take pride in being a woman. And I just think that when it comes to certain forms of radical transgenderism, I won't talk about it far too much. That could be maybe a space for another conversation. Mm. But I think if they perceive that there to be an erasure of women, almost, or rather that it might undermine the integrity of sensitive same-sex spaces, then they will kick up a fuss about that. So I think that's just something for the Labour Party to think about in terms of how they reconcile those various rights.
Yeah. No, I'm just sort of interested in whether you think, because I mean, I guess sort of my perspective as I say is, yes, if you look at the polling evidence, lots of, Muslims think that homosexuality is a sin. But indeed, if you looked at the polling evidence 20 years ago, that would have been true for a pretty large proportion of Brits, certainly the ones over 50. And whether we just think, this is just a question of time, and that actually in 20 years, most Muslims may well be where the rest of the population is now. That this is just something that is part of an integration process that takes place over time.
I think that's a possibility. I think it could be the case that there might be a liberalisation of attitudes down the generations. But I still think that when it comes to the fundamentals, if you could call it that, I think that even among British-born Muslims, that belief that marriage is ultimately an institution between a man and a woman, I think that remained as a mainstream view for some time. Whether or not they think homosexuality is a sin, we haven't had polling on that very recently. But I'd be very interesting to see that. I suspect that, and there is even the argument that in some ways, and this could be because British-born Muslims, they might be more assertive when it comes to minority rights. Yeah. It might be the belief that actually I belong to this country. So maybe they might feel more, there might be that sense of feeling more entitled to certain rights and protections, while their parents, you know, that may come from countries which are deeply socially unstable, rife with political corruption. There's a good number of British Muslims, their parents actually fled from, you know, civil unrest in countries such as Somalia. So they may have naturally positive orientations of British democracy. Whatever Britain may be, at least it's safe. Especially they compare it to their country of origin. So I think my point is mainly that there is that argument there could be a liberalisation of attitudes among UK-born Muslims and then their children who will also be born and raised in the UK. But there may also be a growing assertiveness in terms of their expectations of minority rights and protections under their own democracy.
I mean, one sort of point which sort of relates to that, I mean, I don't know what your parents' background is, but obviously there are a lot of first generation or second generation ethnic minority Brits, people like you, whose parents did not grow up here, but who did grow up here, and who, as you say in the book, are actually considerably more likely to go to university than white Brits from similar backgrounds. And of course, you know, we know that there is, you know, one of the divides that is quite notable in this country, and again, as you say, in some ways, at least as notable as in some respects as divides around race, ethnicity, gender, and so on, is that between people who go to university and people who don't. How do you see that changing British society? And I don't just mean for people like you, but for us all collectively. I mean, it's certainly something that I notice at King's that would have been unthinkable when I went to university in the mid 80s. The proportion for those of our students who are British, the proportion of them from an ethnic minority background, I mean, King's is particularly because we're a London university, and we've made some efforts in this area. You know, the number of sort of first generation, you know, second generation Brits who are the first in their family to go to university is quite remarkable. And you know, I to put my own cards on the table, I think this is precisely what we're talking about. One of the great achievements of the UK of the last 20 years. But how is that going to affect us as a country? I mean, we're already beginning to see it in the upper echelons of certainly politics and increasingly business and the professions.
I think that I like you, I see it as a real positive. I think that it's a multi-ethnic success, you know, modern Britain. I think what's really interesting, so I'm predominantly of Bangladeshi origin. My mum was born and raised in Bangladesh. First time she set foot on an aeroplane, I think she was 20 years of age. But she's a well-educated woman who takes education very seriously. But an interesting dynamic in British Bangladeshi communities is that quite often the first generation parents are not necessarily well-educated themselves. And one of the motivating factors as to why they moved to the UK is because they wanted their children to benefit from the educational opportunities that can be offered in modern Britain. And even though they're not particularly well educated in a formal sense, they want to instill that pursuit of educational excellence in their household. And I think that's very important. I think that many people make the argument that as people, as more and more people go to university, it's going to lead to greater radical progressivism in British society. You're going to have this ever expanding graduate class. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that actually, I think that that effect is, or rather that proposed effect is exaggerated at times, especially by certain commentators on the right who I won't name. Because the reality is that I still think that there's still small c conservatism is still allowed to be expressed on campuses, based on campuses that I've visited. And yeah, there's radical progressivism there, but you still, my old patch, Royal Holloway, you still almost have that sort of old school Toryism, which still also exists on campus. I think that more generally, as the graduate class becomes more ethnically and religiously diverse, I'd make the point that we have quite conservative-minded Islamic societies which thrive on British campuses. Not many people seem to talk about that. We have very healthy ethnic and cultural associations as university societies. So I think this view that as you have an ever-expanding graduate class, that's going to lead to the automatic liberalisation of British public attitudes, I reserve a degree of scepticism. For that view. And I think in some ways, the radical progressivism on campuses, yes, there's some very vocal radical progressive activists on university campuses across the country. But I don't think that's necessarily going to have a huge impact on mainstream thinking in British society. I don't think that will necessarily be the case for some of the reasons that I've discussed.
So I got the feeling when I was reading your book, and it was one of the things I liked about it, actually, that you were sort of in some aspects, you were sort of not quite changing your mind, but certainly developing your views as you went along, as you wrote it. Would you say that's fair? And how do you think your own thinking has evolved over the last 5 or 6 years?
I think that, interestingly, I've been on quite the journey. I think at university I was quite pro-Remain, quite socially liberal, in a sense. Definitely more liberal than I am right now. I think I'm more socially conservative now. But I think that the one thing that I would say is, I think sometimes as you write a book, you do go on your own journey, in a sense. And I think that you put that quite brilliantly, actually. I think, for all its flaws, I'm very proud to belong to a multiracial democracy like ours. But I think that the one thing that I've developed within myself is that not to be too self-congratulatory on that front. I think it's all well and good to say. I think Sundar Kotwala puts it brilliantly that it's not much good telling a young black lad that, oh, well, you're better off in London than you are in Rotterdam, Marseille or Hamburg. You need to give them, because ultimately they're going to compare their experience with their fellow peers who may belong to different racial backgrounds. They ultimately live in Britain. So I think that the journey for me is that I think we can take pride in significant strides, especially when it comes to matters of racial equality over recent decades. But the work's not done just yet. And I think actually, I think that can make for quite an ambitious message that you want Britain to be the truest gold standard example of a thriving, successful and fair multiracial democracy. And I think that's the position that I've settled into, which is quite a nice, you could call it maybe a liberal conservative position. You know, you take pride, there's national pride to be had in the successes we had when it comes to matters of racial equality, equality of opportunity. But that liberal view that there's still improvements to be made in terms of matters of fairness.
So I guess, and then just sort of following on from that, naturally, I think, and perhaps just to finish, looking forward. So, given that, you know, what two or three things would you want to see Labour or Keir Starmer, or indeed the next government, if they broadly agree with your diagnosis and prescriptions, what would you like to see them do or say that would make a positive difference?
I know that Sir Keir is looking to cultivate this progressive, he calls it progressive patriotism, yeah. Isn't it? That's what he calls it. I think there's a progressive patriotism, a core message of that is to say that actually life as an ethnic, racial and religious minority, living as a minority, Britain is one of the best places to live. And I think that, you know, the evidence suggests that. I think that it's quite an attractive message as well. But you blend that with saying, well, there's still work to be done in terms of equality of opportunity and accessing public services in a fair way. I think that's the kind of messaging that I'd like to see. I know that there'll be some activists within the party who think that that'd be overly positive, but I think that's the kind of note that he should strike. I think that more generally, the Conservative Party actually had a golden opportunity to cultivate a quite wholesome multi-ethnic conservatism. You know, just sort of talking about the value of you know, stable families, thriving communities, that sense of belonging and rootedness. I think Labour can take advantage of that, because I haven't seen much of that from the Conservative Party. We had the Liz Truss experiment, which is just sort of materialistic individualism on steroids, really. Managed to tank the pound in quite a remarkable 45 days. So I think there's Labour in a, there's actually an opportunity for Labour to seize sort of small C Conservative territory. Because I think that at the moment is the Tory, the modern day Tory Party is not really occupying that space. But I think more generally, I still think there's, you know, if you're looking at it from a more sort of economic perspective, I still think there's a too much economic precariousness. I mean, the labour market, I understand the need for labour markets to be flexible to a degree, but I think we're talking about family-friendly rights and things like that. I think there's no harm in going in that direction. I think that generally, I think the sort of bread and butter when it comes to sorting backlogs, whether that's the NHS or the, you know, where it comes to the asylum system, I think focus on that. Because I think that the one thing that the Conservative Party is not ranking very highly on, as well as there being a sort of a philosophical deficit at the heart of the Conservative Party, is that they're just not very competent at the moment. That's the truth. I think all too often when it comes to issues such as immigration, is something that we've talked about. Well, if you want a more self-sufficient country, that means strategic investment in particular sectors, whether that's health or social care. I think there's actually, the Labour Party now is actually more trusted than the Conservative Party when it comes to managing immigration. I think the reason for that is that in some ways, the Labour, you know, Sir Keir Starmer, he's made that point that there is an opportunity to wean us off immigration dependency, he calls it, in particular sectors. But he's very honest about that requires, that'll require a good amount of investment. And the reality is, a point that you've made is that that investment will be more effective in sectors that the government has significant control over. I think that's an important point to be made. So in short, it's about those practical, I think if there's these practical proposals, policies which are likely to be effective, and more generally, spread that positive message about British multiracial democracy. Also, the fact that our major cities, you must have heard that right wing rhetoric. London has fallen, Londonistan rhetoric. But if you look at it, though, you know that some of the most beautiful, family oriented and community spirited stories come from London. It's ethnic minority communities there. And I think Sir Keir Starmer should really capitalise and really take to task that kind of right-wing rhetoric. And if you actually look at segregation, I think it's a very important point to make, Jonathan. Our major cities are nowhere near as segregated as major cities in the United States. I think John Byrne Murdoch at the Financial Times, he's done some fantastic research on that. So I think for all its flaws, and I think we can have a debate about immigration integration, when you actually look at our multi-ethnic society, recent study showing that segregation is actually an all-time low in England and Wales, I think there's many positives to tell. Without being overly optimistic, I think that kind of messaging and striking the right tone could be very electorally appealing for the Labour Party.
Well, I suspect that much, if not all of that, would be music to Keir Starmer's ears. So there are some real opportunities there. And I think your sort of point is about the successes of the UK's multi-ethnic model, the work that's remaining to be done, but perhaps even more importantly than that, the fact that actually what most people in this country want, regardless of their ethnic background, are, you know, public services that works and an economy that works in the interests of the whole population, is actually a message that, for by and large, cuts across both ethnic and other lines a lot. You know, is as I say, I think one that will resonate. Well, thank you very much indeed. And just to remind everyone, Rakib's book is called, I'm holding it up now, but you won't be able to see it, but it's called Beyond Grievance, What the Left Gets Wrong About Ethnic Minorities. I recommend it highly. And thanks very much again to Rakib for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan. Thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.